Good morning. Tuesday. It just doesn't have the same ring, does it? It just doesn't have the... I mean, I feel like it's... I don't know. I feel like it. I want to be Monster Truck Sunday, you know, but it just... Tuesday just doesn't have the same ring to it. I don't know why. Welcome to the Michael Duke Show, your home for common sense radio, right here on AM 700 KBYR and Oldies 102.1. Well, it is Tuesday, and that means a lot of things. First off, it means that coming up today will be our normal discussion in hour two with Brad Keithley. But we've got some, we're going to have some interesting stuff this morning leading up into Brad. Man, I spent some time on the phone last night with folks, several folks who'd been down in Juneau. And I got to tell you, some of the behind the scenes stuff that I'm hearing right now is just, well, it's going to blow your mind. Blow your mind. So you're going to want to stay tuned this morning for that coming up in the 7 o'clock hour. In this hour, we're going to hit some headlines here in a few minutes, give you the rundown on some of the things that are going on around the state of Alaska. I'm going to talk a little bit at the bottom of the hour. I've got a reason block where I'm going to talk a little bit about crime in Anchorage and some of the reactions that I think could be problematic, maybe. Maybe is the word that I want to use. We'll talk about that at a reason block at the bottom of the hour. Coming up at the end of this hour, Chris Story is going to be joining us fresh off of his Mexico tour. I just, you know, I told you the guy was sending me messages and pictures all the time of the beach, the sunsets, the riding from the cabana that he, you know, rented there or whatever it was. It was just disgusting. Just he was teasing me all the time. Maybe he's got a little more positivity left over there. I don't know. We'll talk with him about that at the end of this hour. Then, again, we've got that reason block. Then in hour two, we're going to kick off the hour before we get to Brad Keithley. We're going to talk with Representative Tammy Wilson, and we're going to talk with her a little bit about some of the political theater that we saw or did not see behind the scenes in the approval of SB 54 by the House, and how some of the political maneuvering on the part of the House majority seemed to have backfired a little bit. That there was some political machinations going on there where they thought that they had the upper hand on the Senate, and the Senate seems to have outplayed them. And we're going to talk with her a little bit about what they were attempting to do, some of the backstory on what was going on, and why now we're ending up with special sessions and technical sessions, I should say, up until the 21st of November. I mean, another 7 days of technical sessions costing the state even more money. Why? Well, because they were trying to politically maneuver, and they had an epic fail. So we're going to start it off with Representative Tammy Wilson on that, and then we're going to go to Brad Keithley for two big segments. That is a full hour of discussion about the legislature in hour two. Then in hour three, we're just opening the phone lines up. We're just going to open the phone lines up. I got some other stories that I might want to talk about if nobody bothers to call in. But trust me, usually by the time we're done with Brad, we get phone calls anyway. But you add the whole Tammy and Brad thing together, it's going to be an absolute, it's going to be a free-for-all, I'm sure, coming up into hour three, where we just open the phone lines up to you and see what it is that you have to say about everything that we just spent the last 2 hours discussing. So that is the show. in a nutshell today. If you'd like to participate, that's the place to be. By the way, you can always send me an email if you'd like, me@michaeldukeshow.com, me@michaeldukeshow.com. And I'd love to hear from you during the program. If you have a question or something you want to comment on before we start taking phone calls, or maybe you're just a little shy, we could do that as well. If you miss anything today, or you hear something really good and you want to share it with your friends and relatives, well, don't forget, we've got the podcasts are up and available. You can find them on our website at michaeldukeshow.com. That's michaeldukeshow.com. There's two S's in there, Dukes with an S and show. And you can find the links to the podcast on the lower right-hand side of the page, iTunes, Google Play Music. You can listen directly on SoundCloud. You can also pick up the live stream there as well by going to the KBYR logo on the bottom left-hand side of the page, and you can pick up the live stream. Now, it only plays while we are actually broadcasting on the weekdays, 6 to 9 a.m. So if you want to pick up the live stream, that's a good place to do it. And you can check it out. So what else are we missing here? I guess that's it. That is the full rundown of how to participate on the program, on everything that you want to have open for you, and everything else. I should mention that usually we do football and everything else. The Cougars have this week off, so the Washington State Cougars, who we normally play here on AM 700 every weekend, they've got a final regular season game coming up on the 25th. So we're about 10 days away in Seattle as they're going to face off against the Washington Huskies. It's the Apple Cup as the Cougs and the Huskies face off against each other. The Seahawks are going to play on Monday, the 25th as well at 4 p.m. So they're going to be hosting the Atlanta Falcons in Seattle. I guess this weekend is the Stuff the Truck. That's right. Going on in Wasilla, it's the Valley Stuff the Truck. Saturday from 10 to 6 p.m., Q99.7 and Bob FM, our sister stations, they're going to be taking care of the folks in the valley there. We've got some big trucks from AAA moving, and we're going to stuff them full of food for the frontline mission and their food center there, where they help feed lots of folks in the valley. So if you've got some time, you got some canned goods, you got some help, you want to do it, it's going to be at the Walmart parking lot there on Saturday from 10 to 6 p.m. All right, that's the full rundown. That's everything I had. Let's hit some headlines.
Time now for bullet points. Today's top local and national news headlines.
Well, as I mentioned, the Alaska Senate quit the special session, but the House is going to force us to continue. I mean, you thought that they adjourned and were on their way out the door, but the House on Monday said that they're not going to quit the special session. They want senators to come back and consider the governor's tax proposal. Not really, but that's what they thought. So they've decided to hold technical sessions because one body cannot adjourn for longer than 3 days without the agreement of the other. And that means that the Senate leadership is going to have two senators go back every day for the next 7 days and hold a technical session, meaning they have to open, gavel in, and gavel out. The House is going to do the same thing. And don't expect the full Senate to return to Juneau because they're pretty much done. Eagle River Republican Senator Anna McKenna said in a phone interview, the Senate already voted. I don't see the Senate rescinding her action, which means they were done. They gaveled out. This all has to do, by the way, with SB 54, because they kind of caught the House with their pants down on this deal. The House was not expecting the Senate to concur on that. They expected it to go to conference committee. And in fact, there's some speculation from others, myself and others, including Tammy Wilson, that that was the intent all along, and that's why they included this flawed language in it all the way through. We're going to talk with Tammy Wilson about that at the top of the next. You're not going to believe this. It's going to blow your mind. What else is going on? Well, the Anchorage School District got a rude awakening. They did their yearly count. That happens in October, where they sit down and figure out how many students are enrolled. And, they, of course, that's what they base their state funding off of every year. And they were a little shocked when they figured out that they had 715 fewer students than last year. They were expecting a decline, but this was almost three times what they were expecting. According to the district's chief financial officer, Jim Anderson, as reported in the ADN, he said it's unclear what exactly is going on. He said he's not quite sure exactly what's happening. He said, I don't know if more parents have decided to homeschool their children or whether more families moved away, either out of state or to a different school district. I think Bill Pops probably got it a little closer. He said he's the chief executive of AEDC. He said it could be in part due to Alaska's struggling economy. He said, I would say some of the families are moving to the valley because of the cheaper housing costs. And I think we have families who are moving to the lower 48 because the national economy is doing quite well. Yeah, you think? I mean, you think? It's cheaper. Maybe I'll move. But don't worry. You hit us with another tax, I'm sure it'll all be fine. I'm sure if you give us one more tax, we'll be able to pay for all of that and then some. Oh, speaking of tax, just praise the Lord that you don't live in Kodiak. I got a soft spot in my heart for Kodiak. I lived there for about a year and a half, worked in radio there, worked as a commercial fisherman. Well, the Kodiak City Council has voted to raise the city's sales tax cap by 300%. They're doing it to address a $2.8 million budget gap because, obviously, state government is not the only government that can't control their own spending. The Kodiak Daily Mirror reports that the raise means that the sales tax will be collected on the first $3,000 of a transaction, up from $750. That means the maximum amount of sales tax that could be paid in a single transaction went from about $50 to over $200. In addition to slashing at the budget deficit, the council says the cap increase will fund future capital needs, including vehicle and equipment replacement, sewer lift stations, and the St. Herman Harbor replacement. Oh, I'm sure that this won't affect the economy at all. Meanwhile, some community members are concerned that the increase will depress retail sales. You think? A 300% increase? You think that that... Oh, Lord. Why do we keep repeating history? Why can't we control ourselves? Let's talk a little bit about crime in Anchorage, and specifically, I want to talk about a recent article, which I'm not going to read from that article. I'm just going to reference it real quick. We saw it the other day. It came up where they were talking about federal prosecutors are wanting to charge more people with federal crimes in an effort to try and get bad people off the street. And we're seeing one of the first reported incidents of this cracking down now. In regards to a shooting that took place back in August. And that is this is what troubles me. The story that I'm referencing is in KTUU. And the headline reads, Black Angus Inn shooting suspect facing federal firearms charges. Now, there could have been some charges filed against this guy at the federal level for, you know, if he had attempted to buy his firearms through the NICS system, because that's a felony. If you're already a felon, it's already a violation to do so because he would have had to falsify the 4473. And we know that that happens all the time. And in fact, there was something like 40,000 plus applications in 2016, which is the last year we have records for under the Obama administration, 40,000 plus times that criminals tried to purchase a firearm legally through the system by lying and got caught. Okay, got caught in the system when they did it. Now, unfortunately, the Obama administration only prosecuted 44 of the 40 plus thousand people who did that. All of those people could have been prosecuted under, you know, under federal law. But again, it seems like it's arbitrary enforcement. But here's where it got troubling for me as I read this article. So an arrest warrant was initially issued for the guy on August 4th after they found a whole bunch of shell casings. The guy, I mean, he's a scumbag, okay? The guy's a scumbag. He basically fled the area. And anyway, they ended up arresting him. According to the documents at the time of the shooting, APD recovered 16 empty shell casings where he was reportedly observed to be firing two pistols. Then using this evidence, a trooper special agent conducted a firearms interstate nexus determination. Now, this is where, for me, it starts to get a little sticky. Ultimately, the agent determined that if they, the shell casings, were received and or possessed in the state of Alaska, then they had to have traveled in and affected interstate commerce. And that means that they are now, that this is an interstate commerce case. This makes it a federal case. Moreover, Title 18 of the U.S. Code deems it unlawful for any person who's been convicted in any court of a crime punishable by imprisonment of a term exceeding 1 year to possess any firearm and ammunition which has been shipped or transported in interstate or foreign commerce. Now, this is, to me, where it gets a little sticky. Because inside the state of Alaska, really in any state, but inside the state of Alaska specifically, there is nothing that we have that we use, from the Rockstar Pure Zero that I'm drinking right now to the microphone that I'm broadcasting on to the chair that I'm sitting in. None of these items are not affected by interstate commerce. Everything that you're doing this morning, you know, from the clothes you're putting on to the banana that you're eating for breakfast, are all affected by interstate commerce. Now, I'm all for cracking down on bad guys. Don't hear what I'm not saying. I am all for putting the screws to bad people doing bad things. But as we start to expand this net, as we start to look for every tool in the toolbox and start to expand it out, and we start to apply interstate commerce laws to all these different crimes, to me, that is a very, very slippery slope. Now, according to the previous article, this is back in October when U.S. Attorney Brian Schroeder originally started talking about this. He said, often our federal statutes in violent crime cases and gun cases allow for stricter penalties. So we'll work quickly with the state to make a determination on whether those cases ought to go and pick them up federally if it's appropriate. Now, the problem is, of course, that, and here's the argument. Well, we're only using this on bad people, so it doesn't, you know, don't worry about this. This is only, we're only doing it, it's on a case-by-case basis, and it's only against bad guys doing bad things, which on its face sounds fantastic. You know, we want these bad people off the streets. We want these thugs and violent criminals off the streets. My problem is that once they get used to doing these kind of things and working these kind of things, it's not that big a step to see people who get picked up or something arbitrary happens, where then they could be open themselves to federal charges. Some kind of misunderstanding with a homeowner who maybe defends themselves in a situation where a criminal comes in, tries to break into their home, or somebody on the street kind of issue where they're, again, defending themselves or they use a firearm to do so. I mean, these are real possible situations. And in those instances, if somebody doesn't like the cut of the homeowner's jib or something along those lines, they have now opened up that slippery slope to potentially filing federal charges against them. Now, you might say, well, what's the big deal? If they don't have anything to hide, then, you know, what's the big deal? Let me throw you just a few statistics, just in case you were wondering. When it comes down to federal charges, the federal prosecutors and U.S. attorneys in the United States have a success ratio as far as prosecution of somewhere in the 90% range. Now, you might say, well, why is that? They must be badasses. I mean, these guys must be the legal equivalent of Clarence Darrow, which I'm sorry if you're younger and you don't understand that reference, but you know what I mean, right? Matlock or who, I don't know, whoever, whatever attorney, just picture Ally McBeal. That's what it is. There you go. I mean, these guys must just be, you know, Mensa geniuses when it comes to prosecution. Well, no, there's a method to the madness in the federal prosecutorial playbook. And that is once they hit you with one crime, one charge, then they just try and find everything that's related to that charge, and they just start stacking charges. And I've seen this happen personally. I've seen this happen to people that I am familiar with, where it starts off with one federal charge, and by the time it was all said and done, there was 26 federal charges. Started out of something small, and then that's just the foot in the door. And here's what happens. And here's why they end up with a 90% conviction rate, 90-plus percent. I think it's actually like 95 or 96. Because when you have 25-plus charges against you, then they'll come to you with a plea deal. And they'll say, well, if you plead to these two charges, we'll drop the rest of the 26 charges. Or you could take your chances in court. And you might beat all 26 charges, but if you get just one of these charges on you, you'll actually do as much or more time than the deal that we're offering you right now. So go ahead and take the deal. I mean, this is how the system works, folks. And I mean, I just do a little research on this, and it will, I understand taking bad people off the street, but I've also seen good people be railroaded by the system in the last 20 years. I've seen good people, you know, through misunderstanding or just people not liking certain people. I've seen some of these things happen and go down. Now, and this is, again, we've seen this happen before. We've seen, this is the second case. There was another case, two guys robbed a coffee stand at gunpoint, and now they're alleging that the coffee beans that they stole, coffee beans that were imported from outside of Alaska, were found in the suspect's vehicle, and that interfered with interstate commerce. I mean, you see where I'm going with this? Any one of these things, anything that is stolen, anything that is possessed, anything that you use, everything you have is involved in interstate commerce, which opens up any kind of criminal activity. Once you've opened this door, any kind of criminal activity, even, you know, whether it's legitimate crime or whether it's some kind of, like I said, some kind of self-defense situation or some kind of misunderstanding. I mean, you know, there's been plenty of people who've been wrongfully accused by the federal government of things on this stuff in the past. I mean, there's you can read it. I mean, just go out and Google it. There's plenty of cases of this going on. And if they were charged, in addition to whatever else that the feds wanted to hit them with, if they were charged with interfering with interstate commerce, that opens up a whole new, because again, it's a charge for every instance, for every item, for everything. So it could be interstate commerce on the shell casings and the ammunition. It could be on the firearm. It could be on the, you know, the ski mask that you use. I don't know, whatever it is. Everything could be involved in interstate commerce, and each and every one of those ends up being a charge. Again, I'm not saying don't prosecute the bad people. To me, this just raises all kinds of red flags. I mean, understanding how the system works, understanding how their success record that I just threw out there, how that is affected and how that whole game, is played. And understanding that this opens a very, very kind of spooky door for things to be, for things to be piled on you. I'm a little troubled by it. I'll be real honest. I'm a little concerned about that. I'm happy to see people like this guy at the Black Hackers shooting. I'm happy to see him go to jail. Happy to see him be prosecuted. Happy to see him get sucked off the streets. But again, this guy was a known thug, right? He had multiple warrants. I mean, he was not a good dude. At the time of his arrest, he had 5 outstanding warrants, including assault in the second degree and misconduct involving a weapon both in the second degree and third degree. I mean, he was a prohibited person anyway. This kind of, this usage of the interstate commerce thing sets a troubling precedent in my mind to allow the feds into these cases and to, it puts a stiffer penalty on them. There's no doubt about it. But what really worries me is the person who gets sideways with the federal government, who may be an innocent, citizen, or who may just be, who may just be having a bad day and gets railroaded on something like this. And they just start tacking stuff on utilizing interstate commerce because it's become a habit. Gary's on the line. He apparently wants to talk about this with me this morning before we run out of time. Gary, what's on your mind?
Well, I don't have much to say. I just wanted to say, I'm calling from Muldoon, Los Anchorage. And I just wanted to say, I agree with what you're saying, but I also wanted to just put a point out there that if you use a gun in a crime, you're convicted of a crime and you used a gun, I always thought it was a 10-year mandatory sentence. And that's what I think it should be. If you use a gun in a crime, I mean, that doesn't mean protecting your house or anything. That means like pulling it on people at stores or whatever. I just wanted to bring that up. I don't see that happening anymore. And I'm really getting tired of this plea bargain stuff too, of when you have all these crimes down to one or two or whatever.
Sure.
I mean, it's out of hand.
Right. Thing. I mean, you got guys that are repeat offenders. It's like a revolving door. They use a gun in a crime, then they go back out. They're not supposed to have a gun. They get picked up again. They've got a gun again. And yet they're not prosecuting him for that heavier crime of felon in possession or whatever else they're doing. I mean, that's part of the problem. We talk about that all the time, not gun control, but how about we actually enforce the laws that are on the books? I mean, 40,000 people attempted to buy a firearm that were prohibited people, and they prosecute only 40 of them. That's part of the problem right there.
It's terrible. It really is. I'm disgusted with everything. We're in bad shape up here in Alaska. Okay, thank you, partner.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate your call.
Have a good day.
Thank you. Appreciate you calling in. Yeah, I mean, 40,000 people tried to get a gun who weren't supposed to get a gun, and only 40 of them got prosecuted. 40,000 people, that's more than all the people who were killed with a firearm last year in this country. Maybe we should be, maybe we should be enforcing the law. And then maybe we could protect some of these people. Is he still in Mexico? He better not still be in Mexico. Wait, he's still in Mexico? Eric, what are you doing? You're reading your email?
I just realized he's in Mexico until the 21st.
Man, you are killing me. Because I really wanted to beat on him for... No wonder he sent me a picture yesterday. No, Sunday. He sent me a picture Sunday. And I was like, hey, he's going to be flying back and he's going to be tired on Tuesday. And then I'm going to mock him for being tired. And then I realized that now that was ambitious on my part. That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
That's really unfortunate. All right. Well, no Chris Story today. So we can chat about anything. I'll just throw the phone lines open then. How about that? Surprise. Phone lines are open, 274-5297, 274-KBYR, toll-free, 866-610-KBYR. If you'd like to sound off well, now's the time to do it. Give us a shout, and we will discuss it. Whatever it is, whatever you want to talk about. We could be talking about, again, the issue that I just talked about, which is, of course, the federalization of all these crimes. And Eric and I were talking about crimes the other day and some of the penalties and everything else. And have you ever seen it, Eric? Have you ever seen anybody get prosecuted by federal prosecutors, U.S. attorneys?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
But I mean, I've, of course, read through several stories locally and otherwise, but never witnessed it myself.
Yeah, I see these things happening, and I'm a little concerned when I see this kind of stuff go on, because it, again, with that kind of track record, and I'm talking about the federal U.S. attorneys, with that kind of track record where they're getting a 90% conviction rate, nobody's that good, I guess is what I'm saying. You know, on the face of it, nobody's that good. This is all about how you do it. And by stacking up crime on top of crime, charge on top of charge, you pretty much, you know, I mean, let's face it. If they're going to be like, okay, so you got 27 charges against you, and all we have to do is convict you of one to put you in jail for 2 years and make you a felon and take your whole livelihood and, you know, your whole life. That's after, of course, you fought it out in court for however long you fought it out. Or you could just sign this plea agreement, which says you'll go to jail for 12 to 18 months and you'll still, you know, all this other stuff. But you just sign the plea agreement and we'll be good to go. That's a little, so every time you open up anything, and of course, everything in the state of Alaska is involved with interstate commerce because we don't make anything here. That's the thing. We don't make anything. You say, well, we make food, we make consumables. Yeah, we import all the, even things that are manufactured here are made from things that are brought in from outside. Even our hard goods manufacturing. I mean, you could talk about food and everything else, but even hard good manufacturing, we're not manufacturing. Even if you got a company that's like, well, hey, it's an Alaskan ammunition company. Yeah, except for that they buy all their cases and their lead and their materials and their components. I mean, if you break it down to interstate commerce, there is nothing that we're making in this state. Right down to the trust me, I looked into this. I helped craft the Firearms Freedom Act. This is back in the day, okay? This is 10 years ago. No, not 10 years ago. I guess it would have been 2010, maybe. Maybe 7 years ago. I actually put the language together, and I built it all. Now, I had the help of Gary Marbutt, who's with the Montana Shooters Association, because Montana had the first Firearms Freedom Act, and I took a lot of Gary's verbiage, and we worked through it and everything else. But part of the problem with that, the Firearms Freedom Act, by the way, would have mandated that any firearm manufactured inside the state of Alaska basically was ineligible for federal oversight. Part of the problem and the legal challenge with that, though, is always going to be that any firearm manufactured in the state of Alaska would have been made up of components that would have been imported in from other states, thereby being affected by interstate commerce. So I'm kind of familiar with this issue to begin with. But it just really bothers me that they're going to start cracking. And of course, again, it's all about cracking down on crime. So we're all okay with that. We're all okay with that right now. Because, hey, we need that. We need to make sure that we, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's much ado about nothing. Maybe it will never affect anybody. But again, having seen some people's lives get tore up in the process of this kind of stuff happening, it does make me a little nervous. Let's just put it that way. Well, no, it makes me a lot nervous. I'll throw that out there. So we could talk about that. We could talk about state business. We could talk about whatever it is that you want to talk about. 274-5297, 274-KBYR, toll-free, 866-610-KBYR. We've got phone lines open right now. You can also hit us with an email. Email address is me@michaeldukeshow.com. me@michaeldukeshow.com. Your calls, your emails, your chats, whatever it is that you want to throw out there. If you don't feel like talking on the telephone, that's fine with me. I will take your emails and we can talk about that as well. I've gotten plenty of emails over the course of the time. You can also send us a Facebook message, which, by the way, if you you want to follow along with what we're talking about, usually every day we're including discussions on our Facebook page, which is at facebook.com/Michael Duke Show. And if you like and if you follow the page, we will, during the show, while we see it, because I get a little notification every time somebody, likes or follows the page, I'll give you a shout out. I'll say your name. And we'd like to do that, just to do that. You could also do that with facebook.com/AM700KBY. Just go ahead and do them both. That makes sense. Now, coming up tomorrow, we've got an interesting guest. And we're going to one of tomorrow's guests. I'm just typing here. We'll discuss this. I'm just typing it out right now because Rob Borland, who is the owner of Ursa Major Distilling Company, is going to be on board with us tomorrow to talk about the Alcohol Beverage Control Board and their new war on fun. You think I'm joking? There was actually a letter issued by the acting head of the Alcohol Beverage Control Board that is saying, people should not be having fun at distillery or brewery or winery tasting rooms. Shouldn't have fun. That's not the intent of these. You should not have fun. I kid you not. And some of the examples of things that they're considering outlawing at distilleries and breweries and winery tasting rooms include renting out the facility for weddings, parties, or similar event. Festivals, fundraisers, anything with food and fun. I'm not allowing tours after permitted business hours. Hosting alcohol, inks, and brews, a painting party with alcohol. You can't do that. How about Steinholding and yodeling competitions? You can't do that. These are things that they're looking to outlaw at like a brewery tasting room. I mean, have you seen the Steinholding contest? That's where they do this in Germany all the time. They take a Stein, a big Stein, and they fill it full of beer. And they make you hold it out in front of you. That's part of the contest. You've got to hold it out in front of you for whoever wiggles the longest or whatever. Yodeling and all. You can't do that. Yoga class prior to opening for normal operations. For the fee, the yoga class includes a drink after the premises opens to the public. Can't do that. No sales of local crafts on the premises. So it's like a First Friday thing where you've got artwork from local artists on the wall. Can't do that. This is what they're talking about. This is what she's... Now, here's the thing. The Alcohol Beverage Control Board, the director, Erica McConnell, is seeking a clarification from the ABC on this because they're just like, we're just not sure. I need some clarification on issues raised. She's brought a memo to the board with the information saying you need to clarify whether or not this is actually the intent of what's going on. Here's the thing that is like the big thing in the room. The distilleries and the breweries and the wineries, they're the ones that drafted the original law that allowed tasting rooms. So these were all things that were intended to be done because they're the ones that helped craft the legislation. This is, this is government at its finest. We couldn't possibly allow you to have fun in these places. That would not happen. Anyway, I'm shaking my head. I'm shaking my head that this is what's going on. The Alcohol Beverage Control Board discovered a post on the Ursa Major Distilling Facebook page advertising a painting class to be held at your licensed premises. And then she quotes a statute that says, does not allow live entertainment, television, pool tables, darts, games, dancing, electronic games, or other recreational or gaming opportunities on the premises. So no fun. A painting class is considered a recreational opportunity. It's just insane. It's just absolute. Anyway, we're going to talk with Rob Borland about this tomorrow. The Alcohol Beverage Control Board, by the way, was supposed to meet last night, but they postponed their decision on this until the next regular meeting. It was made in part because not all the board members were present. But I got to tell you, this has got some advocates for this kind of stuff up in arms, including myself. You know, Finer Things is my weekend show where we get a chance to do this. And I've interviewed Rob Borland and Ursa Major and all. And I got to tell you, I try to keep politics out of that show, but this just makes my blood boil. I mean, we thought that this thing was going to be, there was some political theater going on here. We're about to get some insider baseball on this from Tammy Wilson, representative from House District 3. Good morning. How are you?
Great. How about you?
You know, not too bad. It's not too bad at all. We're about to jump into this. You and I were discussing this, and I had this conversation yesterday with a couple people. Yesterday morning, I was talking with Mark Fish about kind of all the goings on in the legislature, and I pontificated on whether or not some of the things that were going on in regards to SB 54 before it was passed from the House to the Senate was, I was wondering, you know, was some of this intentional? I was asking specifically about, you know, we know about the problematic constitutional questions with SB 54. And I asked, was this an intent to try and push this into a conference committee where then they could try and hold this over people before they brought it in? And you kind of answered some of those questions for me last night. Let's talk a little bit about how the sausage got made on this whole situation.
Well, first of all, there was a lot of amendments. So there was a lot of fixes that many thought that needed to be, including me, from repealing 91 to trying to amend 54 to take care of 91. So on Saturday, when we did quite a few of the amendments, some of them actually passed, right, through the majority House members who put them forward, but many of the majority did not vote for them. So on Sunday, if you start looking at the people who were voting yes and no on Saturday seem to change quite a bit come Sunday. And in my opinion, it's because if I can't stop them from amending, which they couldn't, you know, we have a 22-18 split right now in the House, then let's see how much basically crap we can put in there so that the Senate has no way of saying, you know, we're going to go, they want it to go to conference, in my opinion. So how do I know that? And what were some of the ones to me, not just people voting for amendments who didn't want any longer sentencing, but I had an amendment to change court view that would have allowed sentencing to be put on court view until I heard some of the arguments of the inaccuracies, and there's no way that I would put Alaskans in jeopardy. But we get them to come up and object. They give all the reasons why we shouldn't. We go on a dinner break, right? And miraculously afterwards, they take away their objection, and it passes unanimously.
Wait a second. The most hated amendment ever, and how it would be the end of the world.
And my amendment.
Yeah, and it was in your amendment. I mean, worse than Hitler. And then it goes to, they go to dinner. They all have a kumbaya moment. They come back and unanimously say, oh, no, this is fine.
And then all of a sudden, the hair on the back of your neck goes, this doesn't make any sense. Right?
What just happened?
So I get this whole thing about, that's when the rumors really start as far as going into conference. And I'm not going to put it into conference. I want the fixes to happen. I don't want to go back to the original 54 because it did not do enough to take care of what we're hearing from the public and how they don't basically feel safe in their homes. So I take my own amendment and I basically get up and ask for it to be rescinded and kill it. because it needs a lot more work, and I'm not going to be the one who puts in a conference. Well, then Representative Reinbold has her amendments, and they come up. And what people, I want to make sure they understand, because they really have put Representative Reinbold in, and kind of, you know, have thrown her under the bus, saying, you know, she put something forward and she knew it was wrong. Well, if you look at the amendments she put forward, they all went in order. And they were all upping the sentencing, not just on misdemeanors, but on felonies. But what had happened was the first one passed, right, by no mistake. You had, at that point, Representative Sponholz and Representative Tarr and a few others who had been voting no the day before, that all of a sudden they're in for more sentencing.
This sounds like a good deal. Right. Same kind of thing that happened to you. It was all bad. It was all bad. Oh, no. No, now it's good.
So they passed the first one, but yet they failed the rest. And that's where the constitutional issue comes into play, is that can you up this one, which puts it close to, if not the same, you know, as a felony goes, and can you do that? Now, what's amazing is I had gone to the sponsor, and so had others, and I specifically asked the sponsor of the bill if there's any amendments that come forward, because they're looking in the background, right, and have a little bit more time because they're not getting hit with amendment after amendment after amendment on the floor. And not one person, not law, not the sponsor, no one came to say that amendment number 12, and there was plenty of time to be able to do that, causes some issues. We need to rescind our actions and deal with this next session, or it's going to most likely throw it into conference.
Right.
Not just that. We have the Department of Law sitting behind us all day Saturday to the bitter end. And on Sunday, they were gone. Where before, if you had an issue and you want to ask, you go right back into the audience, and they were participating and then just missing in action.
Well, and for clarification's sake, again, the Laura Reinbold had all these amendments, and all of these amendments in combination would have fixed and solved the constitutionality question that they're throwing out there right now. But she had them broken up into separate amendments instead of having one kind of omnibus or larger amendment. And because she had them broken up, I would purport that they saw an opportunity here, because again, what, five or six of these people are attorneys. They understand how a lot of this stuff works and how the laws
absolutely.
Are made. And they understood that if they put this one thing in there, in fact, Matt Klayman, it was actually mentioned on the floor that there could be a constitutional issue with this, and yet they passed it anyway, knowing that. Again,
Nine of the majority members. Nine of them voted for it. You know, and so, and just so you know, too, they get to see the amendments before we do. After the amendments were due at 5, we still didn't meet. You know, all afternoon we just sat around and did nothing, and then for another hour as they went into caucus to look at the amendments where we didn't, you know, you had that advantage going as well. But the question is, why did no one step up? And then the frustration is on Friday, then you had the Senate have a finance meeting, and they're going through the amendments, right, and what issues they may have. And you have a person from the courts get up who had also a problem, said that there needed to be a court change rule, which takes 2/3 to be able to do, and there was no such amendment put in. And when asked, did she testify that into House Finance, her answer was, well, nobody asked me, and therefore I didn't say.
She knew there
so
was
I'm
a problem.
I'm supposed to know every question? Yeah,
right.
They knew there was a problem.
She's sitting in the gallery. She's there. She knows that there's a problem, but since nobody asked her,
And that's in House Finance, when anybody can come up, you know, and testify right in front of us and say, these amendments passed, because it was an amendment that passed in House Judiciary ahead of us, and could have said, hey, there's a problem here, and this is what we need to do. Amendment would have been done in House Finance, and that could have been immediately taken care of, because that was an amendment that had already been done before it got to us in Finance, unlike the one that was done on the floor. But nobody did that, because it got to a point where they couldn't stop the amendments. And therefore, if you can't stop them, then just put enough stuff in it so it'll go to conference. And it's like nobody wanted in the Democrats wanted to listen to the public. The public was very clear. There were constituent meetings. I got a whole bunch of emails as well and phone calls about, you know, what was happening to people's vehicles, you know, and they're breaking into their homes, taking stuff. And literally, since I've been in the legislature, I have never heard so many people from throughout the state who just kept saying, I don't feel safe. And that's not good in any fashion. I don't feel safe in my house. I don't feel safe if I park my car, you know.
So,
and some of that was from 91 and some from other things, but they just wanted to just do little bitty fixes and call it a day.
So let's get into the, because we're down to the last 3 minutes here. Let's get down into the why. Because, again, I'm supposing that what they were trying to do was to force, actually, I mean, they understood what was going on, again, because these guys are attorneys. They work with this stuff
all
the time.
And they couldn't stop it, right? Because the votes went away they didn't want it to.
So they were trying to force a constitutional question so that then they could go to conference committees
strip everything out, right? Right. And conference committees, so people understand, it's three senators and three House members, and they compromise. And I think the compromise, I truly believe, would have been going back to the original 54, taking everything out of it, ignoring the public, not concerned about the safety that people felt, and just put in these minor fixes versus what was done after days of amendments, both in House Judiciary, House Finance, and on the floor. And that would have been horrible. I mean, I just can't imagine the outcry that would have happened, and it should have, to do all that work and then be ignored and say, well, that was a nice show, you guys, but we're going to go back because we know better to the beginning and make sure that all these criminals are going to continue to get out. And I just want to bring up something really quick. We have pretrial coming up come January where there's up to 1,500 people currently sitting in jail that could be getting out in some type of form within the next couple months. What's going to happen when we've already had all this bad stuff happening? Do you really believe the administration we currently have and the Department of Corrections that we have as a commissioner is going to pull this off? I don't. Well, and I think you think things are bad now. You just wait a few months and see how they look.
Well, and how much leverage could they have been? I mean, they could have used this to say, well, you know, that's fine. We'll vote to change this. But, of course, we also need to talk about, you know, new revenues. And so we won't vote on the conference until we get this other stuff squared away as well. I mean, I just see it as leverage. But lo and behold, the Senate surprised everybody by saying, nope, we're not going to blink
by
on
doing
this.
The right thing. By doing the right thing.
We're not going to blink. We're just going to move ahead, and we're just going to pass it. And so no conference committee, no opportunity for the Democrats to demagogue, to grandstand, to try and hold them hostage over this bill. That was always my fear, is by adding both bills to the call, is that somehow they would leverage the use of the crime bill to then force the discussion on the payroll tax.
Oh, exactly. That's what the whole thing was supposed to be. And then Friday, the House had 23 members there. And normally what would have happened is that the House would have been in recess until the Senate got done. Oh, no. Instead, what happens is we gavel out till Monday, which means you can't go in Saturday. You can't go in. And so this whole little thing about, well, we're going to have technicals to bring back the Senate. No, they got outplayed. They absolutely got outplayed. They'll do technicals till the end.
Yeah, he could have adjourned to the call of the chair, which means they could have called him back at any time. But instead, he was supremely confident that the Senate was going to take it to conference. And so he just gavelled out till Monday. And oops, sorry, you got
done.
Yeah,
I can't find 21.
Yeah,
exactly. Because you can't sign EDI without 21. And the whole thing about that they still want taxes, which they do. They still want a task of tax Alaskans, although they still haven't fixed this other issue. And it's just incredible that they don't want to listen to anybody but themselves. That's it.
This is the insider baseball that I was talking about. And this is the kind of political theater that just pisses me off. Because this is the kind of games that they're this is the games that they're playing right here. Well, Tammy, thanks for giving us the inside scoop on this. I'm glad you're not down in Juneau having to do the technical. Good luck with this as we move forward. We'll be watching. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you. Bye.
The Michael Duke Show. Pretty interesting. I thought it'd be a good lead into what we were talking about with Brad. Let's delve down into it and talk with him about this and more. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Michael, I'm doing great. How are you today?
You know, not too bad. By the way, Brad Keithley, for those folks who don't know, is the founder of Alaskans for a Sustainable Budget, former oil and gas consultant, now retired, who comes on every week to dissect this stuff with us. So, Brad, before we jump into it, because there's lots of stuff on the horizon, the Chinese gas deal and everything else, your thoughts on what we just talked about with Tammy about this political gamesmanship that was going on in the Senate. I mean, I think we kind of dodged a bullet here because they were going to try and leverage this stuff to bring this payroll tax in front of a combined committee of the House and the Senate.
Well, we're dodging lots of bullets these days. Yeah, it's we're facing a very difficult period with the Alaska Senate, who we've all viewed as sort of the last line of defense to bring spending down, sort of having given up on that role, and now the Senate is trying to find ways to maintain a PFD cut. And to think about additional revenues because they aren't in a position to cut spending further. And that's, yes, we've dodged a bullet here, but I think we're going to continue to face bullets as we go through the next session.
Yeah. Well, and again, I think it was, this was well played by the Senate, and it keeps us again out of the spotlight of potentially having to try and defend against another taking of the people in the form of a payroll tax. So at least I'm happy about that. But let's talk about the big elephant in the room, which, of course, is the Chinese gas deal. Now, I find it ironic that the governor had all this hoopla, the dog and pony show of putting all this stuff together. And yet when it was all said and done, we really don't know anything. And we won't know anything until well after the election. In fact, they're saying we won't even really know the details till late 2018, maybe early 2019, before we know whether or not the Chinese are going to actually put money on this. There's a lot of questions involved here, and I know Nat Herz had a piece where he asked five. You say there might be one that's even actually more than that. Let's talk about it.
Well, let me say a couple of things. First of all, I think this is a step forward. The Chinese have a big market. They have a need for additional gas. One of the reasons that we've had a run-up over the last few months in the spot price of LNG, and we're now LNG's in the $8 and $9 range, one of the reasons we've had is because the Chinese demand has surprised not only the market, but it's to a degree has surprised the Chinese. As they try to deal with their environmental issues arising from their heavy reliance on coal, try to reduce coal, increase the use of natural gas, increase the use of renewables as well, but increase the use of natural gas, they're going to have an increasing, a substantial increasing demand. And entering into some sort of relationship with the Chinese is a positive thing. I mean, yes, the Nat Herz and Alex DeMarbin point out in their piece that there's not a concrete deal, that we won't know the terms of the deal for a fairly long period of time, and that there's other issues with it. But moving down the road with the Chinese, a large market like the Chinese, is a positive deal. And the fact that the Chinese recognized it as enough of a deal to include it on the table during the visit by President Trump, I think is a positive sign. Now, there are that being said, there are problems with it, and there are significant problems with it. Nat and Alex identified some, asking the question, is there a real deal? Is there enough financing to get us there? How will the producers react? Those are all good questions. But in my 35-some-odd years of dealing with deals in the oil industry, I've learned one thing, and that is what's really important when you have multiple parties in the deal is alignment. That is, are all the parties working in the same direction and trying to accomplish something? If you have alignment, you more likely than not are going to be able to get to a deal because everybody's going to find it in their interest to finalize a deal. When you don't have alignment, as much as you struggle to get to a deal, there's always some problem that pops up that if the parties aren't aligned, they're going to be at cross purposes on, and that either generates a significant amount of delay, which kills a deal, or it kills the deal because they just can't come to agreement. And here, the deal with the Chinese is a prime example. The Chinese are in this deal because they want a cheap supply of natural gas. They want a cheap supply of LNG. Alaska should be in the deal. Alaska's in the deal because we want to sell our natural gas at a high price. And the kind of conflict that's going to generate in the various agreements we have to come to potentially is going to be significant. The Chinese are going to come in and they're going to say, okay, we're going to give you financing. We're going to assist with the construction of the pipeline. And our interests will be aligned in having a low-cost pipeline. That'll work well. But the Chinese are going to say, and we want a cheap supply. We want you to sell us the natural gas at a low price. And if you don't do that, then there are other suppliers out there in the market that will talk to more. Yes, we know Alaska. Yes, we know you have a lot of gas, Alaska, but we want it at the right price. And we're going to want a cheap price. And we're going to want a cheaper price still because we're lending all of this assistance to the project.
Right.
Alaska, on the other hand, is going to want a high price. And that sort of misalignment, I think, is what's going to be the most difficult problem as we go through this process with the Chinese.
As an investor and as a buyer, there's almost a conflict of interest in that regard because, I mean, yes, they may be loaning money to the project, doing all things. But again, it almost ends up being kind of a pay for play thing. And that's always where the cross purpose is. The seller always wants to sell at the highest price. The buyer always wants to buy at the lowest price. But usually the buyer isn't involved in helping the seller develop the product.
Yeah, sometimes there is some involvement by buyers in some of these LNG deals. And I think we anticipated that down the road. But what's happening is if the Chinese come in and are going to provide all the financing and all of the engineering assistance, that's going to create a tremendous amount of leverage on their part. One of the things that bothers me when I look at Governor Walker's statements and the other statements coming out of the administration is the emphasis on all these jobs that we're going to generate during the construction period.
Right.
And that's true, but that's a very short-term outlook. Yes, it's going to be in the 2020s, but it's a one-time event of looking at all those jobs and saying, oh, this is a great deal because we're going to have all these jobs. What's really important to Alaska from a long-term perspective is what the sales price of the LNG of the gas is going to be. That's where we're going to make our money over the long term. There's also an emphasis on, oh, we're going to have returns on the pipeline. We're going to have all these economic returns from whatever investment we put in the pipeline through the tariffs that are charged. Well, we can get better returns on our money. Alaska can get better returns on its money by putting it into the stock market. That's what the Permanent Fund Corporation does and does fairly well. So just saying we're going to put money in and get steady returns out of the pipeline, that's not an economic boost either. The really critical thing in how this plays out economically for Alaska is whether we get and the extent to which we get the sales price return on the gas that we're selling. We're actually aligned better with the producers on that issue than we are with the Chinese. And frankly, I think one of the things that we should see out of this is the producers becoming more actively involved on the side of the state of Alaska in the discussions with the Chinese, because they will be aligned in getting the best price.
We're talking with Brad Keithley here, Founders for Alaskans for a Sustainable Budget on the Michael Duke Show, AM 700 KBYR, Oldies 102.1. So, Brad, that's the question that wasn't being asked. What you're pointing out here is the question that isn't being asked. But let's go back quickly here to some of the questions that Nat Herz asked. And I guess let me ask one overarching question, because I'm looking at all this and I'm seeing all this. I'm seeing the timing of it. I'm seeing how it all lays out. And I guess my question becomes, how much of this is political theater on the part of not only Governor Walker, who's looking for a push going into his next election cycle, but also on the part of the Trump administration, which is looking for a win on the Sino-American trade accords and things like that. How much of this is just kind of political theater before we get down into the other details?
Well, I think a lot of it. I think there's a substantial amount of it on the part of our administration, the state's administration, and on the part of the Trump administration. And to some degree, there's political theater on the Chinese side, right, too?
Right.
President Trump has made a point out of emphasizing the balance of trade imbalance between the Chinese and the U.S., and the Chinese get political benefits out of this also by looking like they're trying to do things that help that help balance trade, restore or offset the imbalance in trade to some degree. So there's a lot of political theater going on. But the fundamentals are there. The fundamentals that the Chinese need gas, and Alaska has gas, and Alaska is fairly well positioned to supply gas, and Alaska is fairly well positioned to provide a secure supply of gas to the Chinese. The fundamentals are there, and I don't think it would have gotten to the level, again, having dealt with this for these sorts of things for a while, I don't think it would have gotten to the level of being included on the list of those deals announced during the visit had there not been substance to it. I don't think it's all political theater. I think there's some substance there, and the question is, can we get to that substance and make a deal on that substance?
So that leads us to some of the other questions that were brought up, which I thought were pretty solid. One of the big questions is, will the oil companies agree to sell the gas? Now, there's an argument, obviously, that they have an obligation to produce and to sell. If they're, if you build it, they will come kind of thing, where they're obligated by their leases to sell the gas if there's an intent buyer. But the question is, will they actually sell it? Some have indicated, Conoco said that they intend to sell the gas at the wellhead. But there's some question as to whether the other producers will, because they have other uses for the gas, including pressurizing wells and doing some other things.
Yeah, so that's going to come down to the economics. That's where the state and the producers are aligned. Yes, the producers will be happy to sell the gas if the Chinese wanted to pay $20 an MMBTU for it. No, the producers won't be happy to sell the gas if the Chinese just want to pay a penny for it. So there's an economic strike point in there someplace between where the producers are going to be helpful, affirmative, positive in bringing this to closure, and are going to be reticent about it. There are other uses, as you point out, there are other uses of the gas. There are other ways that there are other technologies that the producers have looked at in the past. Gas to liquids is one. And those all have costs to them. And LNG has looked like a better deal historically compared to those. But if the Chinese want to try to push the price down to, pennies on the MMBTU, then the producers are going to look at the whole card and say, look, there are other ways we can be using this gas, or the gas is going to be more valuable in the future by not taking this short-term deal, what's being dangled in front of us. The producers, there's a lot of talk about the producers have an obligation to sell. Yes, they do, but they have an obligation to sell on economic terms. And if the producers could are of the opinion and can demonstrate that the terms the Chinese are offering are not economic, then the producers don't have an obligation to sell in that situation. So that's going to be the economics of this. The economics of that gas sales agreement is the crucial piece of this. If we get alignment on that, if the producers and the state get to a strike price that they're going to feel is economically justifiable, this project's going to go. But if we can't reach that deal, then this project's going to have all sorts of problems, and that's the alignment issue that sits out there that hasn't come together yet.
My final question before we run the clock out, we're coming close here, but it is really on this. I've been doing a lot of reading on China, and especially Xi Jinping, his leadership of where he's taking China. His actions and kind of his vision from what I'm seeing is a little troubling. And the big question, you've worked in a lot of international deals, and so you've seen this before, but the big question is, should Alaska hook its economic future to China? I mean, we're already a big trade partner to begin with, but should we hook it more to China, which is an authoritarian communist regime?
Well, so the article is great in sort of pointing out the difference between Paul Seaton's reaction and some of the other reactions on that question. We are, if we sell LNG, we're going to be hooked to the Chinese, substantially to the Chinese regardless. They are the world's biggest market right now, the biggest opportunity in terms of LNG sales. Korea's got some demand, Japan's got some demand, India's going to have some demand, but China and Petro-Vietnam is going to have some demand. But China is the big elephant in the room. And if we're going to have an LNG project, one way or the other, we're going to be hooked to the Chinese. This is a substantially greater hooking. The deal that was announced is a substantially greater hooking because they're going to be both a lender and a financial advisor and help in the construction. But one way or another, we're going to be hooked. So I don't think it's a question of should we be hooked. We're going to be hooked. The question is the economic terms in which we are hooked to them.
Well, it's interesting to see, and of course we won't know the details of how we're hooked to them until late 2018, early 2019, which I guess is convenient from a lot of ways, but we'll have more on this. Don't go anywhere. The Michael Duke Show continues right here on your home for Common Sense Radio. We're having some issues with that, and now we've gotten the latest revenue forecast, which we thought was going to be mostly good news, but it turns out it may not be all that and a bag of chips. Brad Keithley joins us this morning. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Michael. How are you doing?
Good, good. Let's continue. We've got the new revenue and expenditures model, which we thought was going to be good because we've had increasing oil prices. We've had increasing production. We've had a bonzer year in the permanent fund earnings and more, but it's not all wine and roses.
I got to tell you, I was stunned when David Teal, the legislative finance director, made his presentation to the first of the Senate Finance Committee and then to the House Finance Committee. Teal was asked to do an outlook for fiscal year 2019. That will be the fiscal year that the legislature is dealing with during the next regular session, looking at what the fiscal situation is at that point. And Teal was sort of asked to make a preliminary look at it based upon the preliminary forecast that the administration had made, both on the revenue side and that the Office of Management and Budget had made on the spending side. And I was stunned when he made the presentation. The presentation shows that notwithstanding the very good news that oil production is up significantly from where it was projected last year, that the projected deficit is increasing. And it took me a second to figure out it took me a while to figure out what was going on. But basically the moving parts are that while production is up significantly, and we all need to be very happy about that, and we need to celebrate that, that the administration has forecast, revised its price forecast from what it had originally used last spring to reduce the price, and that brings the revenue number down. You're showing the Teal's presentation showed, for example, that over the course of the 8 years that they looked at, revenues were down from what had been forecast last spring by about $100 million, going down a little bit, but about $100 million to start off from what they'd forecast, and that's due to the reduction in price that the administration forecast. But I was sort of getting my head around that, and then I looked at the expenditure numbers, the spending numbers, and Office of Management and Budget has substantially increased the spending numbers forecast over the next 8 years from what they included in last year's plan. They explain that those spending numbers that they included in the forecast are all of the services that essentially the Senate and the House approved in last year's budget and then trended up by inflation, the cost of inflation over the next 8 years. So notwithstanding this great news that we've got on the production side, the net of what those two forecasts show, the revenue forecast and the spending forecast, show an increasing deficit over what was forecast just last spring. $173 million increased deficit in FY19, $247 million, a quarter of $1 billion in FY20, $140 million in FY21, and it continues out at that string. So not only, the reason I was stunned is not only are we not getting better as a result of increased production, we're actually getting worse as a result of the revision in the price forecast and the increase on the spending side.
And some of that could be attributed to the fact that they're not including all revenue streams, including the 50% of the permanent fund earnings, which, again, I just mentioned had a bonzer year this year. So they're not including that in the projection. So that's part of it. But again, the bigger part is that they're just it's all this increased spending, and every dollar that's spent has a future impact. Like you said, we're talking about the inflationary. Even if state funding remained flat as far as approved spending, the inflationary component of it means that we're going to be paying for it more and more into the future.
Exactly right. I mean, once you set a baseline, if you say that's the baseline we've got to maintain, and we've got to adjust it for inflation, which makes some sense. Once you set the baseline, we've got to increase it for inflation to maintain that same baseline of service. Once you set the baseline high, you're just asking for trouble as you dig in farther and farther. You're exactly right on including the permanent fund earnings. In a previous conversation, you and I had talked about the fact that the permanent fund had come out with a revised earnings forecast over the next 10 years that was substantially greater than the earnings forecast that they had in the spring, and I thought, well, this is going to help move us toward the solution. But going back and doing a 50-50 take on those earnings, yes, they improved the situation. For example, in FY 2019, before including 50% of the earnings, the deficit is about $2.7 billion, or $2.8 billion, actually. After you include 50-50, it's down to $1.5 billion, but it's still $1.5 billion. And while that deficit goes down some, frankly, because earnings, the revised earnings forecast are, if you include those, 50% of those, we're gaining on it, but we're still talking about deficits that are over $1 billion out till toward the end of the 8-year cycle. So it's what that really focuses on is we have not got our cost structure under control. I know some people will say we need new that proves we need new revenues and we've got to have new revenues, but we're talking about $1.5 billion to close this gap. We're talking about $1.5 billion of new revenues for at least the next couple of years, $1.2 billion in new revenues for several years beyond that. We're talking about some fairly big numbers here. And new revenues, I mean, if we try to raise new revenues to offset those numbers and take that money out of the private sector and push it over to the government sector, then we're going to dig the hole that the private sector is in deeper and deeper and deeper. We already know that cutting the PFD has the largest adverse impact on the overall economy. We know that from the ICER study. We know it has by far the worst impact on Alaska families. If we do that and then we try to take additional new revenues out of the private sector, we're just going to be digging the private sector's hole, the hole the private sector's in deeper and deeper and deeper. The problem that this helps us focus on is our cost structure is just out of line. The state's cost structure is just out of line. And that's not to say that, oh, you know, I'm advocating cutting K-12 or I'm advocating any particular thing. Our cost structure is just out of line for what our revenue picture is, even if we add in the additional revenues from the permanent fund, using 50-50, adding in additional revenues right from the permanent fund earnings.
We're talking with Brad Keithley here, Alaskans for a Sustainable Budget, on the Michael Duke Show, AM 700 KBYR, Oldies 102.1. Brad, you just mentioned K-12. That always seems to be the favorite stalking horse about it when anybody starts talking about, you know, reducing costs and everything else. That seems to be where they go to begin with, because, of course, they want to scare you. They don't want, you know, these mandated services that should be provided. But we're already seeing the effect on the economy. We just got the report this morning. The school district here in Anchorage is down over three times. They expected a decline, but they're already three times what they expected. Some of it is probably people moving out to the valley because of cheaper housing and everything else. But I guarantee you some of that's people just moving out of the state because the economy is recovering in the lower 48 and people figure they've got more opportunity out here. And here it's just a huge question mark. It's going to continue to go down.
It is. And doing things that make that worse by taking additional money out of the private sector, I mean, we're already seeing it with the PFD cuts. taking additional money out of the private sector is just going to make that worse. Government will be great. I mean, government will be financed at a level that it's comfortable with, but the private sector will be sucking money out of the private sector in a way that just keeps the private sector going down and down and down. So we have got to find some balance here. I think the storyline, frankly, Michael, out of what Thiel's presentation was, and it probably wasn't the storyline he intended, and it probably wasn't the storyline that the OMB director, Pat Pitney, intended when she gave these spending numbers. But I think the storyline out of this is, yeah, we've cut a lot of costs, we cut the easy things, but we've got to go in and fundamentally restructure our cost position in this state. We cannot raise the level of revenues that's going to be necessary to cover these sorts of costs. We have got to get our costs down. And frankly, I think the storyline also, and why I think this is going to start showing up in the 2018 election, is Governor Walker has known about this situation. Oil prices went down in the summer of 2014. We knew they were down by the time that he took office in December of 2014. They've been down the entire time he's been in office. He's had 3 years. He'll have 4 years coming up to have dealt with that. And we haven't gotten our cost structure in line yet. So I think this bleeds over to the 2018 election, and is a bad reflection on the time that we've wasted, frankly, trying to deal with the cost side in dealing with the state's fiscal situation.
We're going to hear from them. We're down to the last 2 minutes here, Brad, but we're going to hear from them that, of course, we can't cut anymore. We've cut 40%. We've cut this. We've cut hundreds of jobs. We've cut all this stuff. We just can't cut anymore. What say you?
Well, we can't afford not to. We can't afford not to get our cost structure in line. If we're going to try to raise $1 billion, again, I'm just stunned at these numbers, but if we're going to try to raise $1.5 billion every year out of the private sector, we've only got a $40 billion economy. If we're going to try to raise $1.5 billion by moving it out of the private sector into the government sector every year to try to deal with the deficits that are showing up here, we're going to have a private sector that is not going to be a reflection of anything we see now. We're going to have a significantly diminished private sector. So we can't afford not to take on these costs. We have got to get Alaska's government spending in line with the what we can afford.
Well, and I'm a little worried. Again, we're seeing this is the canary in the coal mine, this school district thing. It's just showing you where things are going. If the depopulation continues, it spreads whatever potential burden down to fewer and fewer people, which just exacerbates it. We've got to get it done now. Brad Keithley, thank you so much for coming in and joining us. It was a pleasure speaking with you. As always, we'll see you next week.
Thanks a lot, Michael. I look forward to it.
We're into hour three right now, and we're opening up the phone lines to take your calls. 274-5297, 274-KBYR. Throwing all those lines open to talk about, well, what Brad and I were just chatting about, the fact Tammy Wilson, that little commentary on what was going on in the legislature, that they knew that this thing had challenges. They absolutely knew. And the gal from the court division that basically said, oh, well, I knew there was a problem, but nobody asked me about it, so I didn't say anything. I mean, is this how laws are being made in this state? I mean, this is how we're all okay with it? We're going to make the sausage this way? It's incredible stuff. We're hoping you're going to call in and sound off this morning. You could also message us on Facebook, facebook.com/Michael Duke Show, if you'd like to message us there, or drop us an email, me@michaeldukeshow.com, me@michaeldukeshow.com. And it's crazy stuff. Todd's on the line. He wants to chat this morning. Let's take some phone calls and kick things off right now. Good morning, Todd. What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, Michael. You know, when you make sausage with spoiled meat, it doesn't taste very good.
Oh yeah, but they'll make you eat it and tell you how great it is. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, you know, I know everybody's had some bad moose or some bad game meat before it. You can add all the spice that you want, but it still tastes like crap.
Yeah, so, no, and that's part of the problem. But they're going to smile and tell you this is exactly how they intended it, And this is, I mean, this is all good. And you know, you just smile and eat it. Just smile and eat it. Just be thankful that they provided you with sausage at all.
Yeah, eat up, little children. I mean, I guess Marie Antoinette said, let them eat cake. We get to eat bad sausage. But, you know, Brad's segments are always great. I love listening to him. And, you know, one of the things that I thought about in terms of the second segment with this increase in spending is somewhere at some point we decided that this automatic inflation proofing for every single thing that the government spends money on is it's just automatic. This is just what we do. And when my wife had her first child, she gave up working. And we didn't look at our dining out budget and say, well, last year we spent $2,000 and we got to increase it for inflation. We stopped eating out.
Right, right. Well, part of the problem part of the problem here is if it was an automatic thing, it would be one thing. But see, it's not an automatic thing. It's there. But see, they use it as a justification. Well, you know, things cost more. Things have to go up, and so we have to do that. I mean, I think if it was automatic increase, as in they automatically get approval, that would be even scarier. But see, now they just use it as, well, things cost more. We're getting the same services. They're just costing more. So you'll understand. That's how it works, right?
No. a lot of us don't understand that because that's not what we do in our own budget. We look at what is necessary, and we look at what are wants and what are nice to haves, and we make decisions based on our income according to priorities. And we don't, unfortunately, we don't have a majority of representatives and senators who look at state spending the way they probably even look at their own personal spending, because it's somebody else's money. My last point is this, that, you know, Brad mentioned, well, you know, in the next election, it's really going to depend on people, or this isn't what he said, but I was kind of thinking this way, that it's going to depend on how much the people understand what's actually been happening with spending. But we have a mainstream media that doesn't really tell the true story about spending. The governor and his administration talks about, you know, a 44% cut, and nobody in the mainstream media questions that. And you don't see that. I mean, what I would like to see is, and since you speak to these people on a daily basis, or once a week, Nat Herz and Ms. Raines, that you would maybe ask them, Do you understand, you know, what the governor means by a 40% cut? I mean, right. Do you understand why that's inaccurate? I mean, I would love to hear them talk about it. I know Nat always seems really cautious not to take sides when he's on your show, and I appreciate that as a, you know, as a journalist, but they're not telling the real story.
Yeah. Well, they're not. Here's the thing. They're not questioning enough, I would say. You know, if somebody says something, if a politician says there's a 40% cut, somebody ought to be asking the question, oh, really? Well, show me how you did the math on that. Show me how that works. Show me where the 40% came from. And then understand, for example, that may have been a 40% cut to coming out of the separate buckets, but maybe it's not a 40% cut to the actual expenditures. We've talked about that, kind of the voodoo economics that we see in this a lot of times, where they could still justify saying we had a 40% cut, but not in actual expenditures, just in general fund spending or undesignated fund spending, not in actual spending as a whole. And again, that's upon us to kind of suss out and pay attention. But hopefully people like Liz and Nat and others would look a little deeper into that.
Right. That's what that's all I'm asking, because, you know, I've written a few opinion pieces, and some of them have been published throughout the state. And the next one I'm going to write is kind of revealing some of this, sausage making, so to speak. But, you know, there's a certain group of people who read opinion pieces, and they're the same people who listen to talk radio. And it doesn't really, you know, in order to have the significant change that we need in the players, it needs to get into the mainstream. It needs to get on the Channel 2, you know, half-hour news. And I know that a lot of them are not interested in that because they're Democrats. And they like a big government, and it benefits them when the GCIs get huge contracts and then they can advertise in their newspapers. So, I mean, I get that. But it's really a disservice to the general population because they're not getting the whole story.
Right. Well, and I'm hoping that more and more people do that, but you're right. In this case, on this program and in these kind of situations, we are preaching to the choir. Because these are the people that are already trying to get informed. They're the ones that are trying to, they're the ones that are trying to make a difference and get all that. We need to find the Joe and Jane Alaskans out there who really don't know what to do or aren't familiar with it. They're taking things at face value. They're like, there's some of the people that you come across that go, well, you know, I don't know. They said that they've cut everything that they can cut. I guess I'll just have to pay a tax if we want to keep the services that we've got. I guess I'll just have to do that because they're busy because they're doing things and they haven't taken the time to educate themselves.
Right, and politics is not their hobby, and that's where we need to look for those openings to have conversations with people and make sure that they really do understand the real story. You know, that the operating budget has only been cut by, well, less than 2%. I mean, that's what they really, when we talk about spending, we're talking about the operating budget spending. And that's only been cut by less than 2%.
Yeah. No, I think you might be right. This might be the place that we need to start taking a look at and go, here, what do we do? How do we fix this? How do we make this happen? Maybe a little bit tougher questioning from some of our mainstream media personalities will help that. I don't know.
Well, I hope you can bring that up with Nat and Liz. I don't expect them to be conservative journalists or anything. But I think it would be an interesting question to ask them, or to ask them, you know, something in that vein.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right. Well, Todd, I appreciate you sounding off on this. Thanks for calling into the program today. I'm hoping that maybe we can get some of this stuff squared away. Appreciate your call. Thank you so much. The Michael Duke Show, AM 700 KBYR, Oldies 102.1. If you'd like to call in and talk about this, now's the time to do it. We're looking for your phone calls and your thoughts on this. Commander Tom said the Tammy Wilson segment should have been called The Games That People Play. And here's the thing. They, being the legislature, and in particularly this point, the House of Representatives, the House majority, are playing games with people's lives, playing games with people's livelihood. I mean, we're talking about an issue that has been very, very contentious, this crime issue. They knew that there was a problem, and they were hoping to use it, to leverage it, to bring the Senate to the table to try and force a discussion on this new payroll tax scheme. And to me, that is, it's manipulative. I guess it's politics as usual. I don't know why I'm surprised. But the fact that they got outplayed, to me, is so sweet in this. So sweet. I have about 2 minutes here, and I know, Roy, you were going to get held till after the break, but let's just take your call now and see what you have to say. Roy, what's on your mind?
Well, Michael, it's just another example of the inmates running the insane asylum down there. I mean, how do we change this? I mean, like you said, we could vote in new people, but they'll get corrupted by, you know, the ones that remain or get voted back in because, my person always does good job and this kind of stuff here. So it's a little, you know. And I'm one of these people that listens to talk shows, and I do try to read the editorial page at times to see, because I looked especially for Idiot Walker's comment the other week there. It just drives nuts, but there's only so few of us. And like you said, everybody's busy trying to live their lives and going, trying to figure out, okay, now the state's going to do this to us. How are we going to put that into our budget, you know, to pay these new taxes, like this 10 cents on the gallon of gas thing here that Mayor Berkowitz has just pushed through down here in Anchorage? I mean, what the heck are we going to do with this kind of crap?
And here's the thing, and here's what I think is going to happen, Roy. I think we're going to get to the point to where it's going to become too late. They'll come to a point to where all of a sudden we realize, we can't back off, and we'll see more cuts. We'll see more people leave. We'll see a depopulation effect, and of course that'll leave this $1.5 billion deficit that Keith Lee's talking about in the future. That'll have to be spread to fewer and fewer people. And that's that tipping point that I talked about here last week. That is that, you know, you get to that point where, where it's this negative feedback loop of there's fewer people, the burden has to be spread. It puts more stress on those fewer people, which causes more people to leave, which causes there to be fewer people. The burden has to be spread even to fewer, you know what I mean? And it's just this self-reinforcing negative feedback loop. And if we reach that point, we're going to be in some serious trouble, because at some point, if you start talking about going from 700,000 to 600,000 people in the state of Alaska, and you're trying to spread that $1.5 billion burden on those people, at what point does it just become too much? I mean, you're talking about having to, you know, getting to retire here in the near future. What does that mean for you if you have 60% of your income, you're having a hard time living now? What options does that leave you on the table?
Well, I'll be one of those people getting on a plane, moving out here, or, you know, in a truck and driving away, because I'm going to be one of the retired people. There's also all our Native Alaskans who don't have regular jobs or regular income, and they were depending on that PFD to come in to help their subsistence lifestyle, to tie them through each year, to buy the fuel oil and everything else that goes on with living up there in that state. And these idiots just got their heads so far up their butts. I mean, it's unreal. I mean, how they can keep on going like this? I mean, Michael, the only thing is, if there's less people demanding services, that might be the only way that eventually some of this somebody might come to their senses. We might as well just cut these programs. There's nobody here. Use them.
You see this article by Tegan Hanlon in the ADN talking about all the students. All of a sudden, the Anchorage School District is short about 700-plus students. They were expecting a little drop, but not, what? Three times what they were expecting means that they're going to lose a lot of money, because they get, you know, thousands of dollars per kid, and now they're losing over 500 more than they were expecting? Ow. What does that mean? Well, I think it portends a lot of stuff, but more than anything, to me, it's the canary in the coal mine. The most amusing part of this whole article, by the way, is that that they were reporting that Fairbanks, Kenai, and Juneau all reported slightly smaller student counts as well. And in Juneau, the number of equivalent students dropped by just over 2% compared to last year. And the answer from the district chief of staff there in Juneau was, well, enrollment has been steadily declining over a long period of time. We had a loss of state jobs in our community, which sort of trickles down to a loss of population. Show me where you had a loss of state jobs. I mean, the numbers that they're reporting is like 75 people out of 25,000 people were laid off. And I can't even get an answer if that's real bodies or just unfilled positions. But even if it was 100 people, that loss of state jobs. Hey, how about the 20 people a day who are losing their jobs? Huh? How about those folks? This is just a canary in a coal mine effect right here, folks. This is exactly what it is. It's a harbinger to things that are coming down the line. David's on the line. He wants to talk with us. He called in to 274-5297. You're welcome to do so as well. Got some lines open. Good morning, David.
Hey, good morning. I remember working with Brad on the Sustainable Education Task Force, and his favorite quote was, "Nothing motivates like lack of money." maybe we're finally going to get the results we want as money dries up. The ASD has a demographics department, and they predict how many students are going to be in the school district, but I don't see any talk about, so how did you guys mess that up so badly?
Right.
I mean, we're still paying the same demographers to give us the wrong information. And, you know, it is a substantial sum because the ASD gets, you know, money per child, and then they get money per child that are special ed. There's extra money, and there's less foreign. It's about $14,000 a kid is what we spend. So when you drop that many children, you're going to have an issue. And just to give you a reference on it, in 1995, we had as many children in the Anchorage School District as we have right now.
Right.
We spent half as much money.
Half as much money. I mean,
half as much.
How do we get
half
here?
As much.
Oh, it's inflation.
Well,
right?
Yeah. You built three high schools, you built three more middle schools, and you added in about a half a dozen elementary schools. Every one of those needs a principal, a vice principal, a secretary, a nurse, a janitor, cleaning supplies, heat, light. And the last time we closed schools in Anchorage was in the early 1980s. And it was a drama, and it went through lawsuits and stuff. I mean, we just don't have a contraction element that goes on with our budgeting. And the formula for the state says keeping a bunch of smaller schools open will get you more money than consolidating schools.
Yeah. Well, and except for now, they've got enough students. They've got enough students down that they're saying, what were they saying? That they could basically, enough students are now going to be missing to fill up two elementary schools. Two elementary schools.
And yet they don't. And then yet they don't talk about, hey, let's close two elementary schools. And the fact is that, you know, most of our schools are somewhere between 40% and 55% of capacity.
Right.
So
right.
They're already half empty.
And how many of those, and how much of that is due to the fact that they've changed the capacity qualification? We saw this in Fairbanks. They had schools that were built with a capacity of like 312 or 350 students. And then over the course of years, they would slowly change what the definition was of capacity. It used to be, you know, one student for every 6 square feet or something. And they start shaving it off. And then it was, you know, one student for every 7 square feet or 6.5 or 8 square feet. And all of a sudden you had a school that was built with a capacity of 350 students, which now maxes out at 300 or 275 students. And now they're like, well, geez, now we need a new school. I mean, it's just, it's a shell game.
ASD does that. They even have their own design specs. They don't use the state's design specs. So almost every one of our schools in the ASD can hold a lot more students than the ASD. Just like you said, you know, it's a 10-passenger van. Hold it. It's a 4-passenger van.
Right. Exactly.
We need more vans.
These empty seats. Oh, but they may need to spread out on that. So we want to make sure that that's.
Well, we need to have more room for special ed and music and PT and stuff. That, you know, we're not going to use those classrooms for classrooms. We're going to use it for other stuff. Because we get paid for the building. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be very interesting.
This is just the warning sign to say, look, this is the first indicator. They were expecting a decline. Which, I mean, to me is always like, yeah, well, what does that show you? But instead of what they expected, they got three times that amount. And that tells me, you know, a couple things. Now, either more folks have decided to homeschool their kids, which I'm sure that's happening all the time. I mean, that's been happening for the last 15 years. We've been part of a homeschooling program since its inception. And we've continued to see this homeschooling program increase in enrollment for years. So I'm sure that's a small portion of it. But overall,
well, it is.
Yeah, but overall, we're seeing charter schools.
Yeah, we're seeing people move. Most of us have noticed that people are leaving. People are moving out to the valley. We haven't heard the specs of whether or not the valley came in even or came in high. They've been having a growing curve. But you know, in the Anchorage School District, you'd have to go back to 1985 to see how many are actually housed inside ASD buildings, because we have a large number of charter schools that have pulled people out of the ASD buildings, too, because ASD refuses to house charter schools inside regular school buildings.
Right.
So we're really not looking at 1995. We're looking about 1982 for how many kids are in actual ASD buildings.
Right. But again, all the justification for, as you said, every one of these buildings requires a principal and supervisors and janitors and secretaries and attendance people. And I mean, all this stuff, each one of those, I mean,
light and heat.
Yeah. I mean, all this stuff. I mean, how much you've been looking at this stuff for a long time, David, tell me, I mean, how many, as a percentage-wise, how much has the administrative side of education grown in just the last 5 or 10 years?
Well, if I go back to 95, the number of teachers was about 3,300, and we now have 2,700, but every other department of the budget has more people than it did in 1995.
So, you know, other than that, we need more support people. Fewer teachers.
Other than the fact that we have one administrator for every three kids, we're fine. One support staff for every three children.
And as far as enrollment goes, I mean, where are we at in 1995 to today? Is enrollment down overall? Up? I mean, where?
1995, that is the number we have shrank back down to, is the 1995 enrollment number. The actual housing inside ASD building, like I said, is about 1982.
So, why do we have so many buildings?
Glaring. The good news is at least they've settled almost all their contracts and everybody got a raise.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was important to make sure we did. Now, here's the argument, David, that you'll hear, because, again, I've been through this and I've seen this before. Well, we should close some of these buildings, or we should sell them off, or we should at least mothball them. Oh, no, that would be – we can't do that, because that would not be – that's not smart. We may need those in the future when we rebound and we have more students in the future. We should do that. You know, and we're still paying bonds on these schools that we built. And so we need to – I mean, again, we get into this catch-22 where we have to have it, or we feel like we have to have it, or we're paying for buildings that are empty or partially empty. And we definitely don't want to sell it because we'll still be paying bonds on these buildings even if we ended up selling it. I mean, it is the catch-22. We painted ourselves into a corner, and now we've got to lie in this bed.
But – at the same time, in our city, we pay for ambulances that we no longer own while we purchase new ambulances.
Right. Of course. here's a radical suggestion. How about we take one of those schools, and the mayor's all hot and heavy about turning things in for, for homeless, housing and stuff. Let's just take one of these schools from the school district and let's just turn it into a homeless. I mean, if that helps, it's already fenced. It's already.
Yeah, that would help. You know, Boys and Girls Club got a national award winning elementary school over in the Spinard area as their new headquarters for $1 from the ASD.
Right. So why not? Let's do that.
It's been serving for another 30 years. Yeah, you could certainly house a whole lot of people in a couple of elementary schools in cots and bunks, and they have bathrooms and heat. Hello.
Yeah. No. And cafeterias. I mean, you could do all that stuff.
Yep.
You could get it all.
You got a place
away.
To serve. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, if you really want to fix the problem, you've got buildings available.
Like I said, hopefully, lack of money is going to motivate somebody soon.
Yeah, well, I hope so, because the only problem is that what it is instead of being motivated to make the cuts that are necessary or look for efficiencies, instead, a lot of times what they're motivated to do is try and find more money from you and me to make it work. That's the problem.
Well, that's already the case, is we're not getting our fair square from the amount of money that comes out of the state because of the school. It's that geographic factor that you correct everything with.
Right.
So we've already heard the argument that, well, you know, Anchorage is more expensive to live in the Valley. We really should be like 1-1 and Valley should be like 1-0.
Exactly. We should be getting more of our money because I mean, David, I appreciate your phone call. Thanks for sounding off this morning. 274-5297, 274-KBYR, toll free 866-610-KBYR. We'd love to hear what you have to say this morning. Let's jump into it and see what you want to talk about. This hour, the program is being brought to you by your friends over there at the Alaska Sleep Doctor. Dr. John Krellick is a certified sleepologist, right? He's a certified doctor of sleep medicine who is, whose main job is to make sure that you get the best night's sleep possible. That's what he's all about. And there's a lot of people out there that are suffering from a sleep disorder. In fact, one in four people, they're estimating in America today, suffer from one form or another of sleep apnea, which can really affect your quality of life. That's why you need to go see the folks at the Alaska Sleep Doctor. He offers a free sleep screening where, he can that initial consultation is free. where he checks you out, sees if you're a candidate. If he is, he can get you a test that you could take in the comfort of your own home. It's pretty simple. It's pretty easy. All you got to do is give him a call, 743-8987, 743-8987. Snoring is bad for relationships and bad for health. You need to check out the AlaskaSleepDoctor.com today, because if your spouse snores, it's a good indication. I mean, especially snores heavily, it's a good indication that you could be suffering, that they could be suffering from sleep apnea, which is dangerous and debilitating. Get it checked out today. Again, AlaskaSleepDoctor.com. I mean, look, it doesn't seem like anybody's getting the message. You know, nobody in government appears to be getting the messages that this is killing us, absolutely killing us. And in fact, they want to double down on it. We saw Anchorage wants to include and now a 10 cent per gallon gas tax increase. We just saw that the city of Kodiak, the city council in Kodiak, just raised their sales tax cap by 300%. This is how they're looking for, couldn't possibly live within their means. Bill is on the line. Bill, what's on your mind?
Well, I hope somebody listens to you guys, because you're right.
Yeah.
Your last caller was spot on with that idea about giving up a school, and you too, of course. Spot on about giving up a school for a homeless situation, and I know how to do it, and I know where you can get training on make it work.
Right. But that would be too easy, Bill. See, that's the thing. And here's the secret, the dirty little secret. It means that somebody else wouldn't get a job to be able to study it or fund it or manage it or do whatever or build a new building or buy a new building. And so we couldn't possibly have that. I mean, use what we have right now. How does that make any sense? If we can't build and expand, Bill, then how would that work?
Well, first off, hire me to be a bean counter to give them ideas how to save, and only pay me with the percentage of the savings that I make.
Wait, incentivize? You can't benefit, you know, Bill, you can't benefit from that kind of stuff. That would be wrong if you benefited from it. Look, I've made those kind of arguments for years. I've made those kind of arguments for years. You know, we get to the end of the year and everybody's trying to desperately spend their budget at the end of their fiscal year to make sure that they get more budget. I've always advocated, you know what, find more efficiencies. Make sure that they're doing a good job. Give them some benchmarks that they have to hit, and then tell the managers that they all get a percentage of whatever money that they save at the end of the year. You want to see things getting done in efficient fashion? I mean, that would be the way to do it.
That's the way I did it in the restaurant business. I was a manager for several years. I got paid on how much I saved, cut back, and made profit for the company. And in my home life, I have to cut budget, trim corners, thanks to Obamacare and minimum number of hours worked a week. Hey, look, there's a church in Leesburg, Florida, that has been doing this for about 40 years. They have a successful homeless ministry of men and women who are trained and put back into the workforce, and they have a very low recidivism rate.
Right. Well, I mean, that would, again, we couldn't possibly let people benefit from stuff like that, Bill. That wouldn't make any sense. I mean, they can indirectly benefit by having a job and expanding their base in their bureaucracy and everything else, but we couldn't possibly make government more efficient and then bonus them or thank them or benefit them by having them help make government more efficient. I mean, that wouldn't make any sense at all.
It's what frustrates me every day.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, man. It really makes me just want to shake my head and wonder what the hell is going on. I mean, how do we fix this? In your mind, how do we fix this?
Well, first, grassroots level. Go knock on doors of assemblymen, congressmen, senators at the state and federal levels. Talk to everybody, and if they don't want to do what they're supposed to, and they don't want to do what they're hired to do, and in my world, you get fired.
Yeah.
So, but get them out.
Again, that would require that we become more efficient and actually hold people accountable for what they do, and so many other things that, you know, we should be getting into, but are not getting into, unfortunately.
That's
all right. Well, Bill,
I hope
I mean,
they're listening to you.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah, I hope they're listening to you, Michael.
Well, I hope so, too. I really do. I hope that the people are listening and hearing what's going on and making a difference, and I hope that we're not just preaching to the choir, Bill. I mean, this would make a lot more sense if we weren't just preaching to the choir, if we could just get folks, you know, on board. I appreciate your call. 274-5297. 274-KBYR, toll-free, 866-610-KBYR. We'd love to hear from you. Please give us a shout right now and tell us what's on your mind, where you're at, what you're thinking about. We'd love to hear what you have to say on this issue. Again, the City Council of Kodiak just showing us exactly what, you know, where we're at. Just showing us exactly what's happening and where we're at. We're talking about a 300% increase to their tax cap, their sales tax cap. Meaning if, you know, if you buy a $3,000, you buy a car, you buy a gun, you buy a TV suite or whatever, you're going to be paying up to $210, up from $52. Because, you know, it's important that you have that. And it just makes no sense whatsoever. I mean, don't you see where this is going? Don't you see what this is going to do to the economy? Apparently not. Apparently that's where we're at right now. We just can't see the forest through the trees, so to speak. And to me, that's part of the problem. If you can't see what's going on here and you can't predict what's going to happen, then we've got a real problem. But this has historically been what's been going on. Again, it's what Brad Keithley talked about, where we are protecting the government economy at the expense of the private economy. That's where we're at. That's what's been happening. They knew, the legislature knew, as they voted on these things, that the number one most detrimental thing that you could do to the economy was to take and attach and defund the PFD. It had the largest adverse impact on the overall economy and by far the worst options for Alaskan families if they went to PFD cuts. And that's what they've done. And again, they're treating it like this is going to be what they're going to continue to do in the future. They don't even reference any other form of revenue. You know, the leaders in the Senate, the leadership in the House, they're in lockstep on this. They both want to see that. And in fact, they both want to see a fundamental change to the way the permanent fund is factored so that down the road they can get more access to that corpus, $60 billion plus dollars. This is not about being more efficient. This is not about cutting back on the size and scope of government. Like all of us, I mean, it's like Todd said early on. I mean, hey, when I saw that I had my wife had a baby and she quit working in the market, you know, and we had a $2,000 bill a year eating out. It wasn't like we could just, you know, go find it. We had to cut back. We had to cut back, and that's what we have to do. And yeah, cry me a river if some of the folks in the state of Alaska, if some of the employees there have to get cut. It's happening. This is what happens when you downsize. I was looking at pictures just the other day. I was just looking at pictures from the radio station from an event that was last year to the same event that happened this year, a year later. And I'm looking at the number of people that were participating, and I realize we've had to downsize at the radio station. How many companies out there have had to downsize their employees? Maybe turn some people back to part-time. Maybe cut some folks' salaries. Maybe all this. I mean, how many of us have seen all that again and again and again and again? Tons of us, folks. Tons of us have had to deal with that. This is not rocket science. If it's going to happen to one person, it's got to happen to everybody. If we are going to cut back, I mean, we're losing 20 jobs a day in the state of Alaska. 20 jobs a day. Commander Tom says there's no private economy or government economy. There's our economy, which is being deeply challenged by the government's mishandling of their budgets and bloated desires. Yes, that is true in that regard, except for the fact that what they're doing is they are playing games of priority with the public economy over the private economy, which in turn, again, about Brad Keithley, again, quoting the ICER report, the largest adverse effect on the overall economy. They may think that they're trying to save the public economy. They may think that they're protecting the government and benefiting the government in the long run, but all they've ended up doing is they're going to lengthen the recession. They're going to make it worse overall. Because a government economy, folks, does not produce anything. Well, but Mike, it produces some jobs. Again, those are all consumptive-based jobs. They depend on the revenue to participate. They're not producing anything. They're not generating wealth. They are net consumers of wealth. The private economy, entrepreneurship, capitalism, that's what generates wealth. That's what generates real long-term jobs. But instead, they want to protect the private economy. Yeah, it produces waste. The government does produce waste. That's true. Waste and taxes. I'm sorry, you're right. The government does produce something. But is that the legacy we want to be left with? Is that the legacy that we want to have? I mean, is this what we're going to pass down to our children? I mean, looking at these numbers that Keithley was talking about, the deficit is going to go up in the next 2 years by $250 billion. And that's all due to one thing, excess government spending. Excess government spending. And the fact that everything that they do is then tied for inflation, and we are committing ourselves to a future where we have to pay for some of these programs. And we've seen it again. I was talking with Bill. I mean, it's a catch-22, or David. It's a catch-22. We've got to have this building. And now that we have the building, now we have to have people that are in it. And now we got to heat it. Now we got to keep it warm. And we couldn't possibly get rid of it now because we may need it in the future. And it'll cost us more in the future if we have to build another one. So we couldn't possibly get rid of it, even though we don't really need it now. And it's a giant sucking money pit. We could need it in the future. So we couldn't possibly get rid of it. Oh, we could start this program, but, you know, only until the federal money runs out. And then, of course, when the federal money runs out, well, we couldn't possibly stop the program because now people are dependent on it. And we've got to do that. Just got to say that it is you hear that sucking sound? You hear that sound? That's the number of people who are leaving communities who are starting to tax themselves, i.e. Anchorage moving to the Mat-Su. That's the sound of other people who are leaving the state overall because they're looking at the handwriting on the wall and they understand things are getting better in the lower 48 and that their money will go farther. Even if they have a lower wage, the cost of living is a lot lower and things are improving so that there's more opportunity. And so they understand that and they leave. Or maybe they're pensioners. Maybe they're on the verge of retirement like Roy and understanding that they're 60% of what they're living on right now, which they're struggling with. Not to mention adding a payroll tax or a property tax or anything else. They understand that even with that, to live on 60% of what they can live on, they could go live somewhere else and have a better lifestyle and be more secure and not die if their electricity gets shut off. You know, that was a question. People are like, well, why would you want to live in one of my buddies was moving to Tennessee. This is a few years ago. And he goes, why would you want to live in Tennessee? I mean, the wages are a lot lower and everything. The guy said, yeah, but you know what? He said, if I run out of money and everything else and I can't pay my electricity bill, I won't die if they shut off the heat. In Fairbanks, you'd die. I mean, the whole place would just freeze up. He goes, I won't die if they shut off the electricity. I could make it if I had to. These are the kind of options that people are being left with, folks. This whole school district thing, I read that this morning and my eyes just got wide because that is the first indicator. The things are about to get spookified. Canary in the coal mine? Yes, sir. That's what it is. All right, we're out of time. The Michael Duke Show. You're on for Common Sense Radio. Back with more tomorrow. Dana Lash is up next on AM 700 KBWire. Beatles Twin Spin on Oldies 102.1.